3. It's the last good close-up picture we have, Bella said, taken about a year ago, when a cargo slug swung by on a routine slingshot. The object displayed on her wall was irregular in shape, 220 kilometers across at its widest point, 160 at its narrowest. The surface was lightly cratered and gouged, the craters soft-edged and shallow. The ice was a tarnished grey-white, the oily colour of roadside snow. "What was a slug doing taking pictures?" Svetlana asked. "University of Arizona paid to piggyback a cam, some kid finishing off a PhD thesis on dynamic ice chemistry. There are better images on the feeds and maps that cover the entire thing down to a res of a few meters, but this is the most recent snapshot in existence." "Still looks like a piece of ice to me," Saul Regis said. "That must have been the point," Bella said. "Janus is about the last place in the system we'd have thought to look for signs of alien intelligence." Nick Thale stirred in his seat. "If they meant to camouflage their activities, why didn't they pick something a bit less weird than a co-orbital moon?" "I don't know. Hide in plain sight? Pick the one place we wouldn't seriously consider looking?" The image revealed no hint of wrongness, no suggestion of alien mechanisms lurking just beneath that shell of icy camouflage. Regis tapped a stylus against the flexi he had spread across his lap. He was a burly man, bald at the crown, but with his remaining long black hair worn in a ponytail. His goatee beard tapered to a long braided tail. "I'm not sure I follow," he said. "What was so unique about Janus? Aren't there a bunch of water ice moons orbiting Saturn?" "Not exactly," Thale said, turning to face the robotics specialist. "Janus was co-orbital with another small moon named Epimetheus. They shared almost the same orbit around Saturn, at about 2.5 Saturn radii. One of them was a tiny bit closer to Saturn, so it moved just a little bit faster. Once every 4 years, the fast one lapped the slow one, overtaking it from behind. When that happened, the two satellites exchanged orbits. The slower one became the faster one and vice versa."
"Freaky," Regis observed.
"It is freaky. Every 4 years, the same thing happens. The moons take turns going fast like skaters running a relay." Bella had read up on it before the meeting. "It's a pretty unusual setup. Definitely not the sort of thing you'd expect to happen by chance, just because two independent moons happen to settle into that." She stopped, because they had all felt something shiver through the room. The glass of water on Bella's desk trembled. She looked at Svetlana. "Are we okay?"
"We're okay.
It's just that I don't remember that sort of thing happening before."
"It's expected," Svetlana said. "We're running the engine in a different operating regime.
So it isn't anything I need to worry about?"
"No, just some mixing eddies in the pre-combustion tokamak."
"Fine," Bella said, but like everyone in the room, with the exception of Svetlana, she had just been forcibly reminded that they were not sitting in some anonymous corporate office building, but were in fact riding 50,000 tons of nuclear-powered spacecraft to the edge of interstellar space with the pedal to the metal. They had been underway for 3 days now, and Rockhopper had already picked up 1,300 kilometers per second of speed compared to their initial vector around the comet. They were traveling at a shallow angle to the ecliptic, in an almost radial direction away from the sun. Every second they were crossing the width of the Gulf of Mexico, putting that much extra distance between them and their places of birth, and they were still accelerating. By the time they reached Janus, they would be 13 light hours from home, far enough that a round-trip signal would take more than a day, and they would be moving at 3% of the speed of light, a figure that was enough to put the fear of God into anyone. 3% of the speed of light was 9,000 kilometers per second. With every minute that passed, they'd be falling further from home than the distance between the Earth and its moon. A minute or two had passed since the tremor. The ship's ride was now limousine smooth once more. Everyone was waiting for her to continue speaking, their faces expectant. It was a nice show, but she doubted that any of them were convinced. Their nerves were already stretched paper thin. For 3 days, the ship had been creaking and groaning like a submarine sinking to crush depth.
"Where was I?"
"Janus," someone said helpfully.
Right.
It's just that until 4 days ago, our best guess was that the two moons must once have been part of the same body. Craig Schrope had done his homework as well. A bigger moon, maybe something Charon-sized. A few billion years ago, something must have hit it, smashing it into pieces. The two largest chunks drifted apart from each other on nearly identical orbits. Hence your co-orbital moons. Bella took up the discussion again. But the Janus event shows that it didn't happen like that. It was set up to look that way. But the co-orbital situation was clearly staged, an engineered occurrence designed to look natural. Before any of you ask, Schrope said, there are teams crawling over Epimetheus even as we speak. With kid gloves, I hope, Nick Thale said. I think we can assume that they're exercising all due caution, Bella said. Not that it seems to matter. Nothing they've done or observed in any way suggests that Epimetheus is anything but what we always thought it was. Unless the interior mechanisms are spectacularly well camouflaged, it's just a lump of ice. The best guess, Schrope interjected, is that Epimetheus is just an ordinary satellite. The Janus artifact must have been introduced from outside the Saturnian system, and its orbit carefully tuned to produce the co-orbital situation we thought we understood. There are other situations like that, right? Asked Parry. No, Schrope said, at least not in our system. Janus and Epimetheus were the only two moons that acted like that. And elsewhere? In other systems? The data isn't good enough for us to tell, Bella said. We have some images of the big Jovians in nearby systems, good enough to pick up major weather systems, ring complexes and Titan-sized moons, but we still can't begin to resolve Janus-sized objects. So, in other words, this might be unique, Parry said. Or it might be a common enough situation that you can expect to find one or two co-orbital pairs in every system, Bella said. Right now, we have no idea. But it could be unusual, Parry persisted. In which case, doesn't it begin to look like maybe that was the point? Bella leaned forward, interested. A calling card, you mean? I'm just saying we shouldn't rule anything out. She nodded sagely. Parry's right. We keep open minds and we consider all possibilities, no matter how outlandish. The instant we start making assumptions is the instant we're going to run into trouble. But we're not trained for this, Svetlana said, looking around the room. We're tool pushers. Bella says we have to keep open minds. I say it isn't our job even to worry about that. It isn't that simple, Bella said, although God knows I wish it were. We have just 5 days at Janus, less if the moon speeds up. That's 120 hours, of which every single minute will be precious. The problem is time lag, Schrope said. He spoke softly, but with a measured ease that suggested a planned statement. We'll be too far out to phone home. Bella nodded. We'll be compressing and transmitting all our data back home, of course, from the moment we're in sensor range, and the experts in near-Earth space will be on it like a pack of hounds. But the earliest we'll hear from them is 26 hours after we send back the first images. Once we reach Janus, we won't be able to afford to wait that long for instructions. Still won't make us specialists, Svetlana said. But we're still 18 days from our objective, Bella said. That's why I've called you here. I want you to start thinking like specialists. Parry laughed. Just like that. You're all smart cookies, Bella said. If you weren't, you wouldn't have got within a country mile of my ship. None of us knows the first thing about alien life, Svetlana said. Maybe not now, Bella said, but a lot can change in 18 days. No one's expecting green monsters to come crawling out of that moon when we pull alongside, but we have to be ready to answer. If Janus says hello, we have to be ready with something. Saul Regis fingered his elaborate beard. He wore a Cosmic Avenger sweatshirt, showing the fictitious crew standing around the workstations of their sleek 30th century starship. How would this work? Us becoming specialists, I mean. As of now, Bella said, I'm putting together a contact working group. I want to keep it small and flexible, which is why I haven't invited all the chiefs to this briefing. She nodded at Regis. I want you to chair it, Saul. I've looked at the background files of everyone on this ship, and of all of us, you look to be best equipped for the job. You've studied cognitive science and artificial intelligence at research level, and our best guess at the nature of Janus is that it's some kind of robot. I feel overqualified already, Regis said. I'm not expecting blinding insights, just some basic familiarity with the landscape. Does anyone have any objection to Saul chairing this working group? She waited a heartbeat. No? Good. That's settled then. Regis held up his hands in mock surrender. I still don't know what you actually want me to do, Bella. Start by assembling your team. I think we can take it as a given that the people in this room ought to be on it, if only because we'll be the ones at the sharp end when we start near Janus operations. I want you to keep the team focused and agile, but you shouldn't discount bringing in anyone else you feel can add something. Bella flicked her flexi across the table. There are some names you may want to look at. Regis peeled his own flexi from the wall. It had fluttered there to recharge its batteries, drinking power from the embedded grid. When he touched it, the two devices exchanged secure data via the myoelectric field of his own body, bypassing ShipNet's open channel. I still don't know where to begin, he said. Let me show you something, Bella said. She turned to the year-old image of Janus on the wall. Her hands moved across the keys on her desk. With a flourish of flickering hexels, the image changed abruptly. It was still Janus, but now the image was fuzzy, like a photo of a stone taken through smeared glass. This is a synthetic image, Bella said, a visible light composite assembled using long baseline optical interferometry, put together from data obtained by 6 different deep space telescopes within the orbit of Mars. It's the most recent long-range picture we have of Janus. It was taken less than a day ago. The picture showed a different angle from the flyby snapshot, so the shape of the moon and the distribution of its craters looked different, but more than that had changed. There were dark patches in the ice that had not been there before. A second glance showed that the patches were actually wounds, voids where huge scabs of ice, kilometers thick, had come free, or boiled off, or simply ceased to exist. In the dark zones, suggestions of mechanical structure twinkled at the limit of clarity, enormous dark machine parts, curved and coiled, nestling tight as intestines. Definitely the money shot, Parry said. The camouflage is breaking away, Bella said. Janus, whatever it is starting to show its true form. We already have something to work with. The fact that we really are dealing with an alien artifact, and not some bizarre physical process we just didn't understand. That's not much, Parry said. There's more. I mentioned that Janus is leaving our system at a shallow angle to the ecliptic. Well, now we have a much better handle on the trajectory. Bella made the image shrink until it was an off-white pinpoint against a star map, marked with star names, constellation boundaries, and faint lines of right ascension and declination, the astronomical counterparts to latitude and longitude. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a star, and we have a name. Which is? Parry asked. Alpha Virginis, the brightest star in Virgo. Bella highlighted the relevant star. It was the nearest one to the small image of Janus. Now, I'll admit it's not exactly the kind of sun we'd have expected aliens to come from, she said. Not only is it hot, heavy and blue, but it's also part of a binary system. Maybe they didn't evolve there. But we can't ignore the evidence. That's where Janus is heading. That's the place it now calls home. So the Janus builders, Svetlana said. What do we call them? Virgins? Virginians? Alphans? None of the above, Bella replied. We name them after the classical name of their destination star. Alpha Virginis is Spica. She pronounced it carefully. Spica, lingering over the syllables. The Janus builders are the Spicans, and they live 260 light-years from Earth. She beamed at her little gathering. There, don't you feel as if you know them better already? About this mission, Parry said. Is it too late to change my mind? They all laughed, but not as much as Bella might have hoped. CNN wanted an interview. Bella took a cam down into the aeroponics lab, attached it to one of the plant racks with a dab of GeckoFlex. Aeroponics, with its humid air, mechanical breezes, and the soothingly regular chuffing of the aerators, always put her at ease. It was the only place on Rockhopper where she could close her eyes and feel, fleetingly, as if she were back on Earth.
It must be quite a burden to be leading this mission, the anchor doll said in her perky, almost cartoon-like voice.
It's a responsibility, certainly, Bella said, but I have a good crew under me. I couldn't ask for a better team.
You must be apprehensive, though.
I have a duty to exercise professional concern. Janus may throw some surprises at us, but that's been the case with every comet we've ever steered home. There's never been anything routine about pushing ice.
How do you think you'll react if you meet a real-life alien?
As opposed to a not-real-life alien? Bella fingered one of the plants on the rack. Patent numbers and copyright symbols were embossed into the glossy green leaf. I don't think it'll happen. I think we'll find automated systems, that's all.
How do you feel about that?
Bella shrugged. We'll take pictures, run scans, maybe try to extract a physical sample, but I'm not expecting great conversation from a machine. The anchor doll huffed.
Well, we machines may have something to say about that.
Yes, Bella said.
The doll brightened again. Captain Lind, you're in charge of a pretty big ship. But it was never designed for this kind of mission, was it?
Show me a ship that was. Bella tried not to sound defensive, but we're versatile enough. We're equipped for remote science studies. It's just that we'll be doing a different kind of science from the sort we're normally used to. But we'll cope. We're professionals. She looked into the cam with what she hoped was the right steely-eyed expression. Out here we have a saying. We push ice. It's what we do.
You'll have to run that by me again, Captain Lind.
What we mean is this. We get a job to do and we finish it. My crew are the best. We've got people from the moon, people from Mars, people from the orbitals, people from marine projects, a bunch of underwater guys, vacuum and water. They're not that different, really. The anchor doll's face defaulted to one of its blank states. Bella had lost it again.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the rest of your crew?
Well, they're all good people. I wouldn't want to single any one person out.
We've had reports that your second in command is going to die,
the doll said cheerily. Jim Chisholm has a condition, that's all, Bella said testily, one that needs treatment sooner rather than later.
How do you feel about that?
I'm not thrilled about it, obviously, nor's Jim. But we can still get him home in time. In fact, and Jim agrees with me here, Janus is actually our best bet for getting him the medical attention he needs. We'll be home and dry in 6-7 weeks.
Let's hope so, Captain Lind. Moving on, do you deny reports that you're carrying nuclear weapons?
Nothing to deny. We're carrying FADs, fragmentation assistance devices, that's all. If we hook up to a comet that's an odd shape, we might want to chip a few pieces off before we try to push it back home.
Some sources say Rockhopper's mission is to plant those devices on Janus and destroy it. Can you comment?
I can comment by saying I find that a ludicrous suggestion. Isn't there something more constructive you'd like to ask me?
How do you respond to accusations that much of the technology aboard Rockhopper that is now being used for commercial purposes was developed with UEE funding, specifically ring-fenced for the purposes of averting Earth-grazing asteroids and comets?
I can't comment. I just have a job to do.
Thank you, Captain Lind. And now to finish, would you like to issue a personal statement to the people back home? Something that encapsulates the way you feel about this mission, your hopes and fears, as you carry the torch of humanity to a place beyond our wildest imaginations?
Bella stared into the cam. The moment dragged. The anchor doll kept looking at her with a lopsided smile of hopeful expectation. Somewhere in the aeroponics lab, the aerator wheezed moisture into the air.
No, Bella said. Nothing.
She reached for the cam and was about to tear it from the rack when something like surrender washed over her.
Okay, she said, knowing that CNN would morph out her hesitation, making her response appear seamless. I'll say this. This is a hard job we've got to do. No question about it.
The entire world is depending on us not to make a mistake. We're embarking on one of the most critical expeditions in the history of space travel, maybe in the history of travel, and not one of us has been trained for it.
Take my word. My crew are the best in the business. But the business is comet mining. We push ice, and we do it pretty well. Exploration of alien artifacts definitely wasn't in the fine print when any of us signed up for this line of work, but we're going to do our best. When we get to Janus, We're not going to sleep until we've squeezed every last bit of data out of the thing. No matter what happens, we're going to keep sending information home. That's our promise to the world.
Bella caught her breath before continuing. I just want to say a word or two about my people. None of us got orders to go to Janus. We received an official request, one that we were free to disregard. I put it to the vote. Some of us wanted to do it and some of us didn't. It happened that the majority won the day. But since we took that decision, there hasn't been a second when I haven't thought about the others, the good people of my crew who didn't vote for Janus. These are all people who have families and friends back home, and yet I haven't heard one damned whisper of dissent from any of them. From the moment we lit the engine, they put themselves into this endeavor with absolute unflinching commitment. It's no more than I expected from my team, but that doesn't mean I'm not proud of them. I couldn't ask for a better crew, and we're coming back in one piece. You can quote me on that.
Thank you, the Anchor Doll said. And now, would you mind reading out this brief promotional statement?
Bella poured a nip of Glenmorangie into Svetlana's glass. They were sitting together in Bella's office, as they often did at the end of a busy or stressful day. Bella had dimmed the lights, allowing the fish some rest. She'd also put on some music, a soothing cello piece that Svetlana didn't recognize. It was nice just to have something washing over them quietly. This was one of the few places on the ship where music didn't have to compete with pumps and generators. Bella tipped up the bottle, coaxing out the last few drops. That's the end of our fun, until the next rotation at any rate.
You get whiskey on the resupply? Svetlana asked, startled. For some reason, it had never occurred to her to question Bella's source for this rare treat.
Not officially. If there's a resupply tick box for single malt, I haven't found it yet. She laughed. But I do have my sources.
Like who?
Bella lowered her voice, as if the two of them were sharing confidences in a playground. Cargo shuttle pilots, mostly. Usually guys with at least 20 years' service under their wings, and most of them started on the Earth-Mars run. Like Garrison, of course. Svetlana found herself glancing at the picture of Garrison Lind on Bella's desk, even though she had seen it 1,000 times. He was a startlingly handsome young man in a bright orange spacesuit, his helmet tucked under one arm, grinning broadly, backdropped by an enlarged emblem of one of the old multinational space agencies. She looked back at Bella.
I guess they knew Garrison.
Knew him or knew of him. Ever since, of course. Well, it's not been a problem for me if I need little favors doing. They could get into trouble if they're ever found out. So I do my best not to abuse their kindness. She shook the bottle one last time and returned it sadly to its shelf, next to another empty one. However, it may be time to abuse it again.
I'm sure they love doing something for you.
They're good guys. They must have had a lot of respect for Garrison.
I guess they did.
Svetlana thought that Bella was about to change the subject, the matter concluded, but then she was off again. He was popular with most of the people he worked with. Only had to walk into a room and people just clicked with him. I know there are a lot of people like that, but it wears off pretty quickly. But with Garrison, people never stopped liking him. They sat in silence for a long while. Sometimes when Bella spoke of her husband, Svetlana judged that it was only because it was necessary to mention him at a particular point in a story. At other times, Svetlana was less sure. On more than one occasion, she had left the room feeling as if Bella had been guardedly hoping they might continue talking about Garrison. But, as strong as their friendship was, Svetlana had always backed off. She had never lost the fear that pursuing the subject might hurt Bella more than she realized. Yet now, more than at any other time, she sensed that Bella was inviting her to talk about Garrison, to voice the unasked questions that always sat between them.
How long has it been now?
She ventured, knowing that answer without being told. She could count as well as anyone.
21 years,
Bella said with a quick smile. I can tell you to the number of hours if you want. I don't know why exactly, but I've been thinking about him a lot in the last few days.
I suspect Janus might have something to do with it.
Svetlana sniffed the amber liquid in her glass, sampling the peaty aroma. I suppose so. Garrison would have loved to have been part of this.
He'd have killed to have made it aboard if he knew what we were going out to do. He'd already have been proud of you. That's what I keep telling myself, as if I haven't already lived up to enough imaginary expectations. Bella looked carefully at Svetlana, seeming to wait until a lull in the music before continuing. I've never told anyone this, okay? Svetlana nodded and said nothing, almost holding her breath in expectation. 10 or 12 years ago, maybe longer than that, I went through a bad patch. Bella paused and lit a cigarette. Garrison was always the more ambitious one. He was the one with the big ideas, the big dreams. I never saw myself sitting aboard a ship like Rockhopper with 150 people under me. Even Garrison would have considered that somewhat optimistic. Times change, Svetlana murmured. She didn't want to interrupt the story. Not as much as all that. Bella smoked unhurriedly before continuing. After Garrison died, I kept on moving. Mostly it was sheer momentum, not looking back, making all the right career moves. Earth to near-Earth ops, near-Earth to the moon. I hated it. I can still feel that dust in my eyes. Svetlana smiled. Everyone hates the dust. So I skipped to Mars, then skipped Big Red to Deep System. And then this thing happened. All of a sudden I crashed and burnt. Couldn't function for shit. They cycled me back to Earth and the tender mercies of the company shrinks. Depression, they said. Trying to live up to Garrison's lost potential, they said. Like I was trying to have his career since he couldn't.
Were they right?
I think they were half right. Another part of me thinks they just couldn't deal with me. Little Bella Lind, daring to have a career in space. She let out a self-deprecating laugh. Okay, so I burnt out. But the men around me were burning out as well. You didn't hear the shrinks telling them they were trying to live up to someone else's potential? It's still a man's world out here, Svetlana said. Every now and then something happens to remind me of that. Like I'm on some kind of probation. We'll let you manage the expensive toy for now, but the moment you slip up... I know you work twice as hard as anyone else in your team. Not because the work's that difficult, Svetlana said, though she knew there was no need to explain. Just because they won't tolerate one single mistake. I know. I know exactly how you feel. Svetlana sipped at the whiskey, determined to make it last. I get a bit defensive sometimes. Before this Janus thing happened, I snapped at Perry. He was on my case about the repairs taking too long. Probably because I was on his case, Bella said. We were both to blame. Perry for not knowing that I was already doing everything possible to get that work finished, and me for not understanding how much pressure he was under to get that driver tapped. You squared things with him?
You know how it is with Perry and me. We're pretty tight. Things like that don't last long.
You're a good couple, Bella said. Take some doing, keeping a relationship together out here. Not many places you can sulk on a ship.
I guess if we were going to murder each other, we'd have done it by now.
That's a good sign. Perry wants to go home. Says he soaked up enough sieverts for one lifetime. He's talking about putting in for transfer.
I heard, Bella said quietly.
He's flagged Mike Takahashi as a possible successor. I suppose he wants you to go with him?
That's his plan. Move back down to Earth, get married, have a kid or two.
Perry says he can find work at one of the training centers. Failing that, he says we should open a dive school. Dust off those PADI certifications.
Sounds pretty idyllic to me.
Svetlana sighed. The trouble is, I worked damn hard to get out here. I'm the chief of flight systems on a fucking nuclear-powered spaceship, Bella. It doesn't get much better than that. Except when someone's squeezing you about repairs. She smiled and Svetlana grinned back. Okay, so that part sucks, but the rest of it's pretty good.
Bella stubbed out her cigarette and lit another. Svetlana wondered if the cigarettes came up on the cargo shuttle with the Glenmorangie.
So what's the plan? Rotate or stay?
We keep putting off having a proper discussion about it, or rather, Perry does.
Maybe putting it off isn't such a bad idea, Bella said. To a certain degree, we're going to be famous when we get back. Not all of us, but certainly the senior crew. You're going to need a damned good agent, put it like that. There'll be book and film deals, chat shows, lecture circuits, game development.
A lot of possibilities are going to open up. That's what Perry keeps telling me. I'll be sorry to lose him from the team, if it comes to that, but my loss would be your gain. I could do a lot worse than Perry. You making it work gives me hope for the human species. After a moment, Svetlana said, "You could make it work too, if you wanted to." Bella smiled tightly. "I don't think so." "Why not? You've got a good few years ahead of you." "Let's not go there, all right?" Svetlana persisted. "You still turn heads. I know you've had a relationship since Garrison died. We've talked about them often enough. What would we do without In Vino Veritas?" Bella shrugged philosophically. "Right now there isn't time in my life for anything but this job, especially now." "Okay, fair enough. But what about later, when this is all over? Like you just said, a lot's going to change." "I worked hard to get here, Sveta, just like you did. I'm not sure I could give all of this up. You've run this ship for 4 years without a hitch. If there was ever a point that needed making, I think you can consider it adequately made. Time to move on, you mean? Like Perry says, there are only so many sieverts you can soak up in a lifetime." Bella gazed at her fish, dark shapes patrolling the unlit gloom of the tank. "It'll be good to get back home for a while, that's for sure. But sooner or later you'll want to come back out here. I want to see the things Garrison never got to see, before it's too late." "I understand," Svetlana said, and she knew that whatever emotional ties still bound Bella to her dead husband, whatever matters of the heart remained as yet unresolved, they were too complex, too fraught, to be unknotted in a single conversation, even between the closest of friends. Bella's tone lifted. "Before I forget, I wanted to thank you. You could have made life a lot more difficult for me with that tech input. Instead, you came through and gave it to me straight. I appreciated that. I guess we're all in the same kettle boat. All the same, it was appreciated." Bella leaned over to pat the wall of her office, her hand dimpling the soft display surface, and, barring the occasional tremor, she seems to be holding together pretty well, doesn't she? "She'll hold," Svetlana said. "Lockheed the Khrunichev build them good." Paul Kagan had attached a media file to his latest message, an image of the rival spacecraft, captured during engine startup tests by the long-range surveillance cameras of the UEE's Replicating Technologies Inspectorate. The new ship looked recognizably Chinese. Some lingering influence in its pale blue-green architecture spoke of dynasties and dragons. "The unofficial word is that they're calling it the Shenzhou 5," Kagan said. "It means sacred vessel number 5, apparently, and that name has some historical significance for them." From time to time, an irregular stutter of hot white light shone from the flared trumpet of the ship's fusion drive. Chemical rockets, stationed around the hull, counteracted the impulse from the fusion motor. The Shenzhou 5 was still encased in a cradle of support modules, with a moth-like shuttle docked at the largest habitat block. It looked tiny next to the looming new spacecraft. "The RTI has demanded inspection rights," Kagan said. "They've credible evidence that the Chinese have put a forge vat aboard, so that they can grow equipment after the ship's left Earth orbit. Beijing's stonewalling, unsurprisingly. Ingao will keep up the squeeze to get those inspectors aboard. But even if she fails, it doesn't look like the Chinese will be going anywhere fast. Our analysts say their tokamak design's flawed. They'll be lucky if they get that thing out of orbit, let alone onto a Janus intercept. But in the unlikely event that luck turns out to be on their side, and if our political leverage fails, you'll need to be prepared for a more complicated scenario than we originally envisaged. I'm pressing Inga to rubber stamp an upgrade to your status. If we can rebrand Rockhopper as an official UEE expedition, that will give us a lot more room for maneuver." "How so?" Bella mouthed soundlessly. "There's still some fine print to be looked at," Kagan said, "but our reading of the situation is that UEE expeditionary status would automatically designate an exclusion volume around Rockhopper. If they ignore it, you'll be authorized to use reasonable force to prevent commercial claim jumping. Of course, Rockhopper is not technically an armed vessel." Kagan paused.
I'll speak to you as soon as I have word from Inga. He signed off. Bella sat staring at the blank flexi in a stunned funk. She had not asked for her ship to be reclassified as an instrument of the UEE, nor had she asked for permission to shoot another ship out of the sky if it violated her company's interests. Rockhopper had been underway for a week now. Around the system, a massive coordinated observation program saw every large civilian telescope trained on the fleeing moon. Even military spysats had been pressed into service, diverted away from the monitoring of hair-trigger frontiers and treaty violation hotspots to peer into deep space in the direction of Virgo. Commercial communications networks had been reassigned to cope with the mammoth effort of merging the data from this awesome concentration of surveillance. From near Earth out to the cold, dark territory of the outer system, space hummed with intense, fevered scrutiny. Every day took Janus further away. But every day also saw more aperture and processing power coming online, and for a little while the human effort outweighed the moon's increasing distance. The images had sharpened, revealing the urban intricacy of the Spiken machinery under the now broken and incomplete icy mantle. What they were looking at was definitely alien, but at least it stayed still and allowed them to feel as if it obeyed something like logic. The newest images uploaded to Rockhopper came with nomenclature, features in the machinery that had been given tentative, resolutely unofficial names: Junction Box, Radiator Ridge, Big North Spiral, Little South Spiral, Spike Island, Magic Kingdom, Crankshaft Valley. None of it meant anything, but it was comforting to put some human labels on the alien territory. Bella thought she could deal with the alien territory. She had signed up for that when she agreed to take Rockhopper out to Janus, but no one had warned her that she might also become embroiled in a hair-trigger standoff with Beijing. Not technically armed, Kagan had said, but both of them knew full well what that really meant. She looked at the fish tank, idly contemplating the mistake everyone made in assuming she'd used part of her mass allowance to make it happen. That wasn't the case. As she'd explained to Svetlana, everything in the tank was already mass-budgeted into the ship, except for the fish. Even the glass was surplus window material, stored here as opposed to somewhere else aboard Rockhopper, glued into a temporary watertight box. If refurbishment ever came calling for the glass, they'd have a fight, but it was theirs, in the small print. No, the tank hadn't cost her 1 gram of her mass budget, but she'd had to pull some serious strings to make it happen. It was a perk. So was the big room with the carpeted floor. No one else on the entire ship had a carpet. No one else had decent soundproofing. This, she supposed, was when she started paying for the perks. She had always known it would happen one day. That didn't mean she had to like it. "Sorry to dump on a friend," Bella said when Svetlana arrived in her office, "especially when you've just got off shift, but I need your help with something." "What are friends for, if not for dumping on?" Svetlana scrunched a finger through her hair, still wet from the shower. She wore jogging pants and a dive chick t-shirt, printed with a mermaid and moving shoals of animated fish. "What is it now? Someone wants another slice of you?" Bella shook her head grimly. She had already farmed out several interview requests to her senior officers, including Svetlana, and they'd lapped her up, the bright Armenian-American girl with the mind of a nuclear engineer and the body of a one-time champion free diver, one who just happened to be romantically entangled with a space miner with several commendations for bravery during EVA operations. Now even the diffident Parry was getting his 15 minutes, squirming like something found under a stone. "Too good to be true," they said. Bella pulled a thick stack of printouts from her desk. "This is a bit different, I'm afraid. It's delicate, very, very delicate. It can only be entrusted to a safe pair of hands. Suddenly this is beginning to feel like a major dump. They don't get much more, Major." Bella passed the stack to Svetlana. "What you've got there are copies of 100 paintings, selected from over 56,000 individual entries submitted by American schoolkids between first and third grades. Artistic media range from fingersmears to, well, something approximating brushwork." Svetlana slipped off the rubber band and leafed through the first few sheets.
Aliens, she said in a numbed tone of voice. They've got the kids painting aliens.
It's educational, Bella said.
It's scary.
Svetlana held up one of the pictures, something that resembled the business end of a blue toilet brush, smeared with enthusiastic daubs of green. Aren't we supposed to be stopping the kids getting nightmares, not encouraging them?
That's for the education system to decide, not us. Our job is to grade the efforts, that's all.
Oh, right. So, 5 minutes' work, right? We just pull a few out at random?
Bella grimaced.
There's a bit more to it than that, I'm afraid. They'd like us to comment on the pictures, say something nice and constructive about them.
All of them. Even the more artistically challenged ones.
All of them?
Bella nodded sternly.
All of them. In enough detail that no one's going to get offended. No one's going to think we're not approaching this with due diligence.
Holy shit, Bella.
And we'll be steering clear of expletives, obviously.
We?
Oh, I've got my own stack of homework to grade, don't you worry. You drew the long straw on this one. I'm the one who'll be up all night reading creative assignments about me and my ship meeting aliens.
Svetlana slipped the rubber band back around the printouts.
This can't get any worse, can it? I mean, as if we didn't have enough to be doing as it is.
This is nothing. Yesterday I had the Cosmic Avenger fan club on my back. They wanted me to comment on which of my crew members best approximated the various fictional characters and how I'd have dealt with scenarios from the show if they happened to me.
I hope you told them where they could shove it.
Bella feigned horror.
Oh, no. I just put Saul Regis on the case. Man for the job.
Men for the job, Svetlana agreed, nodding.
Well, I guess that made him happy.
As a pig in shit.
Talking of which, I do hope you've lined up something nice and juicy for Craig Schropp. There's a man with way too much time on his hands.
Bella leaned back in her seat, sensing an opportunity to get something out in the open that had been troubling her lately.
You and Craig. It's not exactly an eye-to-eye thing, is it?
We've been over this.
I know. He's a suit, you're a hands-on type. But we need suits as well as tool pushers. Craig's a damn good asset to this company. As bitter a pill as this might be to swallow, he's actually quite good at his job.
We're off the record now, aren't we?
Absolutely.
He rubs me up the wrong way. He's always giving me shitty looks, especially if I venture even so much as an opinion in his presence, as if I wasn't head of flight systems, but some lower echelon grunt with only a few hours of wet time under my belt.
Craig gives everyone shitty looks. I think it's genetic.
Bella paused, wondering how much it was wise to disclose.
Look, I'll let you in on a secret. He's not had an easy ride out here. Deep Shaft tried to keep a lid on it for obvious reasons, but his last assignment on Mars.
Svetlana looked mildly interested.
Go on.
Head office sent Craig into the Shalbatana Bore project. There'd been reports of corner cutting, dangerous working practices, questionable accounting.
Bella lit a cigarette, taking her time. She always enjoyed spinning out a story.
Craig uncovered a viper's nest of high-level corruption. At every turn he met with obstruction and hostility, mostly from hands-on types like you and me. Physical violence, death threats, the lot. But Craig sorted that mess out. He turned Shalbatana around. Within 6 months they were digging faster than any of the other bore sites, and they had the best safety record on Big Red.
I heard he made a lot of enemies on Mars.
Enough that head office decided the only way to keep him on the payroll, and in one piece, was to move him on to another project. Hence, Rockhopper. But don't give Craig a hard time because he has a grudge against tool pushers. Good old tool pushers sabotaged his suit, tried to throw him down a service elevator, threatened to get to his family.
Svetlana looked down. I didn't know he had a family.
There's a lot we don't know about each other, Bella said. And he's wrong about us, of course. This is as tight and well-run an operation as any in Deep Shaft. But you can't blame him for carrying some suspicion over from his last assignment. It'll just take a bit of time to rub his corners off. Then he'll fit in, I'm sure of it.
Okay. I'll try to be patient.
Svetlana said. But I still want to see him getting his share of homework.
Don't worry. That's taken care of. He's got a list of high school science questions as long as my arm.
Svetlana patted the stack of printouts on her lap.
I'm glad we can talk like this. I mean, openly, without any barriers.
And I'm glad I can dump on you when needs arise. Bella sucked on the cigarette. Like you said, what else are friends for?
On the eighth day, Bella called an emergency meeting of the chiefs. She gathered them in her office and sat impassive, wondering what they imagined the problem to be and secretly relishing their squirming discomfort.
What is it? Svetlana asked, the first of them to break the silence.
Bella stood up and peeled her flexi from the wall. It came to life in her hands. She held up the brightening panel to her audience.
This, she said.
There's a problem with ShipNet,
Nick Thale asked, looking, like all of them, at the top-level menu.
There's nothing wrong with ShipNet, Bella said. That's functioning normally. The problem's more obvious than that. It's staring you in the face.
They looked and looked. They still couldn't see what she was talking about.
Do you think the menu structure needs to be reorganized to take account of our new mission profile?
Regis asked.
Perhaps, but that's not why you're here.
Look.
The flexi needs regenerating, Parry offered.
Yes, it does, but that isn't the problem either.
Bella sighed. They weren't going to get it.
The problem is the mascot. The problem is the penguin.
I don't... Svetlana began.
Oh, wait a minute. You don't think...
Oh, Christ. Why didn't we think of this before?
Parry looked at Svetlana.
I still don't get it. What's the problem?
You really don't see it? Bella asked incredulously. Don't you see what the mascot actually looks like?
It looks like a penguin to me.
And what's the nice penguin doing, Parry?
It's holding a drill, a jackhammer.
Oh, hang on.
Look at it through alien eyes, Bella said. The way that penguin's grinning. Don't you think it looks just a tiny bit fierce? It even has teeth. Whose funny idea was it to put teeth on it anyway? And that drill. Don't you think there's a danger it might be mistaken for some kind of...
weapon, Svetlana breathed.
Holy shit, Parry said, and started laughing.
They might think we look like that, Bella said. They might think we're the penguin.
And that we're armed, Svetlana said.
With flippers? Parry asked.
What about the flippers? Bella returned.
Don't you think they'll find it rather odd that we've managed to build and fly a spaceship with just flippers? I mean, that would take some doing, wouldn't it?
Maybe they'll assume we bioengineered ourselves to have flippers once we'd achieved a sufficiently advanced technological support society, Saul Regis said.
You could go back to flippers if you had robots to take care of you. In Cosmic Avengers Season 2,
the issue is not the flippers, Bella said firmly. The issue is the fact that our mascot might give cause for concern to our friends from Spiker. It might just make them decide to shoot us out of the sky.
Fine, Nick Thale said. So remove the mascot from ShipNet. That can't be difficult, can it? It isn't even as if we'd be giving them access to ShipNet anyway.
ShipNet isn't the difficulty, Bella said patiently. The difficulty is the 20-meter-tall penguin painted on the side of this ship. The difficulty is that someone has to go outside and paint it out.
Under thrust? Svetlana asked incredulously.
Under thrust, Bella said. And while they're out there, whoever it is can take out some blue paint and slap a large UEE where the penguin used to be. As of today, we have official blessing from the United Economic Entities. Everyone on this ship has just been assigned temporary diplomatic status. She offered them a confiding smile. It's time to start taking this seriously, people.
Parry was in the EVA preparations room, flanked by racks of bright orange Orlan 19 hard suits. He fixed the cam against the wall, then stepped back into its field of view, adjusting his usual red cap. They had asked him to wear a deep shaft bib cap, but he had to draw a line somewhere.
You'll get into trouble, Svetlana warned, sitting cross-legged on a storage pallet. Even I had to put the damned uniform on.
Took me a day to find it, but I still had to put it on.
They can sue me afterwards. There are a ton of deep shaft logos in the background. Isn't that good enough for them?
I doubt it.
Parry warmed the Flexi and started up the anchor doll.
Okay, he said, addressing the Flexi. You can do your thing.
Hi, said the helium-voiced anchor doll. You're watching CNN. I'm talking to Parry Boyce, 37, head of commentary surface operations aboard Rockhopper and lucky partner of hot new science pinup Svetlana Barsegian. How are you feeling, Parry?
Okay.
That's good to hear. No nerves? No second thoughts?
Nope.
That's great. The anchor doll beamed her approval. Parry, when you reach Janus, you'll be in charge of any activities that involve humans working in the vicinity of Janus, right?
Right.
Could you tell us a little more about how that'll happen? I mean, how will you actually get out there?
We'll EVA.
EVA.
The doll looked thoughtful. And for the people at home, that means
extravehicular activity.
That's great. And what does that entail, exactly?
Parry shrugged. Activities outside the vehicle.
The vehicle being?
Rockhopper.
That's great. And these activities? What would they be exactly?
Janus operations.
Meaning activities taking place in the vicinity of Janus, right?
That's about it.
That's great. And when you talk about activities taking place in the vicinity of Janus...
The anchor doll paused, distracted by Svetlana's sniggering. Parry looked at her.
What?
She was creased up on the storage pallet.
You're a natural, Parry. It's the way you open up, the way you give so much of yourself. They're going to love you.
He reached up and tore the cam from its gobbet of gecko flex. If I have to do one more of these, I'll strangle someone, starting with you. Svetlana put on her best innocent look.
Me? What have I done?
You know full well. It's you they're interested in, not me.
I can't help that.
Well, you could try being a bit less, well, clever and attractive for a start. I'm glad you put them in that order. I'd hate to get the idea that my physical attributes have precedence over my intellectual ones.
Svetlana pouted, drawing her knees up to her chin.
She was wearing skin-tight zebra-print skiing pants and a low-cut sleeveless turquoise vest, a combination Parry had always found particularly alluring.
Or is it because you think my physical attributes are somehow less impressive?
Did I say that?
Not as such. You could, however, have been taken to imply it.
You still look pretty hot to me, Barsegian.
Ah, shucks. You're just saying that.
No, I'm not.
She eyed him coquettishly. Prove it, then.
Here and now. I think there's an EVA party due through in about 10 minutes.
Oh, right. The dreaded killer penguin.
She sniggered. Well, we wouldn't want to take their minds off that vital mission, would we?
No, we wouldn't.
He leered suggestively.
Which only leaves one question. My place or yours?
Yours, he said after a moment. That extra 50 cubic centimeters makes all the difference. There was never much privacy on a ship, but Svetlana and Parry made the best of what they had. Her room was little more than a horizontal slot, probably modelled on the most austere and claustrophobic brand of Tokyo capsule hotel. There were 150 similar slots, ringed in three tiers around the lower part of the hab, each containing just enough room to sleep, store a few personal effects, and, now and then, snatch a few moments of precious seclusion. Svetlana had to climb a ladder to reach her slot, then twist sideways through the gap before sliding shut the long plastic door. It was a squeeze with just one person, and a kind of three-dimensional puzzle with two. But Svetlana and Parry put up with that, and with some ingenuity they had mapped out a range of positions that could just be accommodated without either of them suffering too many bruises. Making love was the only time when Svetlana welcomed the ship's constant background noise, even though she could never quite disconnect her attention from the rhythms and cadences of that mechanical music. Parry sensed and tolerated her slight absences, while reminding her that it didn't always have to be this way. He meant the two of them returning home, to that sparkling, sunlit dream of the dive school. Parry was a diver at heart.
He'd come into space because it was work. He shrugged off the differences between water and vacuum as if they were two mildly different states of the same hostile environment, but Svetlana knew where his heart was. She sometimes missed her diving days, but it didn't gnaw at her like a disease, unlike Parry. Dive culture was still thick in his blood. There were two kinds of people in this world, buddies and non-buddies, people you could trust and people you left on the shore. EVA was wet time. He talked about braille dives and incident pits as if they were all still back at sea. She loved him, but she loved space as well. Now she worried about space getting in the way. He lay against her now, blissfully calm, only just awake. After they had made love, Svetlana had fallen asleep as well, but now she was prickly and alert, trying not to think about their future. She had glued her flexi to the wall and navigated shipnet to the news feeds, hoping to blank her concerns. CNN was running Bella's interview on heavy rotation. Parry watched it over her shoulder. "I couldn't ask for a better crew," Bella was saying, "and we're coming back in one piece. You can quote me on that." Then the image morphed into Bella saying, "We push ice. It's what we do." "Got to hand it to the little lady," Parry said, his unshaven chin bristling her neck. "She sounds like she means it." "She does. They're going for it, too. Her picture's everywhere. You'd think she put this ship together with a spanner." "She deserves some credit," Svetlana said, and then regretted the defensive way it had come out. "She gets all the credit she needs from me, babe." "I know." It was true, too. Some of the men had issues with female authority, but Parry wasn't one of them. "It's just that I know some people are going to resent her for this, and I can't stand that. They have no fucking idea what she's been through to get this far." CNN were running a biodoc on Bella, scraped together from video clips taken at various points during her career. Now the flexi showed a young Bella suiting into an ancient dust-smeared Orlan, somewhere on the moon. Every now and then they'd break away from the story to cut back to Bella saying, "We push ice. It's what we do." The words began to drill into Svetlana's skull. "I think they're beginning to get an idea," Parry said. "Good for Bella. High time she got some exposure. Maybe it'll change things for her. Things need changing." Svetlana turned down the flexi. "We had one of our heavy discussions the other night. Nothing you need to tell me about if you don't want to." "It's all right. It's not as if Bella expects there to be any secrets between you and me. We talk about you often enough. Only the good stuff, I hope. With you boys, there is only good stuff. All we do is sing your praises. Your ears must burn." "They do, but that's just the millisieverts kicking in." "Ha!" She hated it when he joked about that kind of thing. "Anyway, we were talking about life stuff, and we got around to Garrison. Not the first time. The first time she really seemed to want to open up about it, although even then she clammed up pretty quickly as soon as we got serious. It's as if she wants to talk about it a bit, but not too much. So it's still painful for her. It's been 21 years, Parry. You've got to get over stuff eventually. Maybe we shouldn't judge. Neither of us has lost a partner the way she did." "Okay. But I've known people who have lost loved ones, and they found a way through it eventually. People are different." "I know, but for Bella, it's as if she can't move on. She's as good as admitted she's having her career for Garrison." Svetlana rolled over on the bed to face Parry. "What I keep thinking is it must have something to do with the way he died." "No warning, you mean? It can't be the same as losing someone to an illness. They never had a chance to say goodbye to each other. They weren't even together before he set off on that flight. Bella was back on Earth at the time, waiting for Garrison to get the rotation home. Even if they'd had a conversation before he went out, it must have been over the Earth-Mars network. Serious time lag. Not exactly conducive to intimacy. And neither of them knew what was about to happen." "Unfinished business, you mean?" "I keep thinking about that tiff we had the other day, Parry. When you were on my case about the repairs, and I bit your head off about it." He stroked a finger against her breast. "I think we kissed and made up about that one." "I know. But what if we hadn't ever had that chance?
We both went outside the ship after the row. You went down to the Comet. I went on EVA to nurse the robots. Anything could have happened to either of us. But it didn't. What if it had? We don't get paid a lot of money because the company likes us. We get paid because it's dangerous out here. I tell you, I'm never stepping into an airlock after a row. Not again. We make up, and then we go outside.
He looked at her, marveling. That conversation really got to you, didn't it?
I don't want to lose you. I don't want you to lose me. I don't want either of us to go through whatever Bella's been dealing with for the last 21 years.
Maybe Janus will change things then. Let her move on. It's going to be a landmark in all our lives.
That's what Bella says, Svetlana said, remembering how they had talked about Parry's desire to go home.
Wait until Janus, then think things over. Wait until Janus.
I love you, Barsegian, Parry said, pulling her into a tighter embrace. But I wish you'd stop worrying.
Flexies had been plastered to the wall, their edges staggered like bricks to form a ragged array that showed an object that could only be artificial. Fuzzy, glimpsed at the resolution limit of the massive interferometric telescope, but unmistakably a made thing. It was a pipe, round in cross-section, 10 times as long as it was wide, formed from some kind of lacy framework. It resembled the fruit-like skeleton of a tiny, dead marine creature.
We don't know what it is yet, Bella said to the small group of people who had assembled in the gymnasium. All we know is that we'd have seen it years ago if anyone had thought Spiker worthy of a closer look. What we'd have made of it if we'd found it before now is another thing entirely.
The image being displayed had arrived on the uplink just 30 minutes earlier. It was still embargoed from the media networks, so the news hadn't made it onto the general access shipnet channels. Bella had not insisted that everyone attend the meeting. Though this was connected to Janus, it wasn't of specific importance for their mission, and she had no wish to increase the burden on an already overworked crew. All the same, most of Saul's working party had taken up her invitation, as had a handful of interested stragglers from other departments.
"You mean this thing was just sitting there all this time?" Parry asked. "Just waiting for us to notice it?"
Bella smiled.
"It wasn't that simple. It took a massive coordinated effort to obtain this image. It's the kind of observation that's made about once a year, when some exo-solar planetary alignment is particularly favourable, and someone thinks there's a chance of imaging an ice cap or a continent. A month ago, if you'd have suggested Spiker as the target, you'd have been laughed out of the room."
How big?
Asked Regis, hesitantly, as if the question were a kind of heresy that could only be voiced in the most trusted company.
"Big," Bella said. "Really, really big. The structure appears to be floating somewhere close to the Lagrange point between the two stars, where the gravity fields cancel each other out. If that's the case, then the object is truly enormous, 17 or 18 light seconds wide, and nearly 3 light minutes long. If you placed the Earth at one end of that tube, the other end would reach to the orbit of Venus."
"Agreed on big," Regis said.
"You'll notice that the long axis of the tube isn't aligned with the vector joining the star's center of gravity. Even if that were the case, there'd still be unthinkable tidal stresses working to stretch the tube. But with the tube tilted like that, the two stars are trying to snap it like a dry twig. And yet there isn't a hint of deflection. To the limit of our observational abilities, it appears completely oblivious to the gravitational gradient across it. It's absurdly rigid. It can't possibly be made of any material exploiting ordinary interatomic forces."
"One more question," Svetlana said, raising her hand, "and possibly a stupid one. What is it?"
"We don't know. We'll probably never know unless something at Janus gives us a clue, but we can guess. Spiker is where Janus is headed. It must be the place it calls home. This is where they live."
Svetlana looked scornful.
"In that thing? In a piece of scaffolding?"
"Just consider one of those longitudinal spars," Bella said. "If we're right about the scale of the object, then the spars are half a light second thick. Now imagine that those spars are hollow cylinders with habitable living space on the inner surface. Just one of the spars would have an internal surface area equivalent to 50,000 Earths. and there are 20 of them. That's a million Earths' worth of living space, and that's if they don't utilize the cross struts. If they do, you can easily double that figure.
Bella smiled at Svetlana.
Is that enough room for you, or do you need more?
Bella had hoped for laughter, but something about the looming spike and structure had touched them all on some disagreeable level. Janus was one thing. It was clearly the product of a culture far in advance of human capabilities. It spoke of a technological gulf that was centuries, even thousands of years wide. But the spiken structure crushed those easy assumptions. This was not the result of a gap that could be measured in the cozy units of historical time. This was a geological gap, and it required appropriately geological thinking. It spoke of millions of years of disparity. At the very least.